Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, why you should care about Roman law. And Richard, longtime listeners of this show, and especially our other endeavor over at the Law Talk podcast with you and John Yu, will know that it has become something of a running theme with us, that you can, through sufficient exertion, bring any legal discussion back to the topic of Roman law. And so we have long batted around the idea of indulging this long enough to give you an episode about this topic, and that day has now come. So we should also note, for people who are interested in more on this, that you have a video series on this that's available through the Federalist Society. Let me start with what is probably the most obvious question here, maybe the one our listeners are asking. Is this topic purely a matter of historical interest, or is there some relevance to the study of Roman law for the modern world?
Well, the answer to that question is clearly the latter. Roman law, it turns out to be an incredibly useful subject if you know it. And if you don't know it, you don't know what it is you're missing. So, you know, let me start to mention some of these things. For example, there's a huge debate over the scope of the public trust doctrine and the role of the government with respect to common property. The origins of that are in the first passages of Justinian, where we note that the commons are open to all and private properties are excluded by one. Trying to figure out what those duties are means that you have to develop the notion of a fiduciary. That's, of course, a Roman law notion. The notions of bona fides and due care, which have dominated the modern law, come right out of the Roman law. And if you don't understand the way it works there, you're going to have a very hard time working today. And so I taught today the class in property law, as we usually do. And sure enough, in fairly early fashion, when you're trying to figure out how some of these go, you make multiple references to these Roman law stuff. Let me sort of put it to you the following way in the simplest form. There's very little of the Roman law of patents that you have or copyrights because certain kinds of technologies just did not exist. The Roman law of the spectrum is not there. But in topics in which they knew about, which is loans, bailments, partnerships, sales, hires, estates, and so forth, they represented such a remarkable advance over everything that went before them because they were able to systematize the entire operation in a set of very workable categories, most of which have survived today. And so when you teach this stuff, what you do is you show the way in which they solve an ancient problem, and then you give the precise analog to a modern problem. So one of the interesting areas about Roman law is the problem about formalism and guarantees, and you start to show how it is that they managed to standardize these things through various rules, have notice requirements, and so forth. And then you say, well, now tell me a little bit about securitization, which is a very modern phenomenon. And it turns out you use exactly the same rules about the way in which you aggregate large numbers of separate interests that were used by the Romans many, many years ago. And so on and on you go like that. And there are many topics, for example, having to do with what makes a contract valid, in which the Roman solutions are actually better than the Anglo-American solutions, because they're not as wedded to the notion of consideration, that the only thing that counts as a contract is something in which there's a bargain for an exchange of either money or property in exchange for the like thing from the other side. And it turns out that's just not correct. There are many voluntary contracts, and the Romans have this classification which allows you to understand and to start to apply them, to develop standards of care and so forth. And so when I teach this to my students, I'm always pleased when somebody comes back from the summer. And I mean, this has happened to me many times, and it's one of the nicest things could ever happen to you. A partner will go to one of these kids of mine and will start to say, I don't understand that. Which course did you take which gave you so much sophistication in dealing with modern commercial and financial transactions? And the students would answer quite truthfully, why, it was Roman law, of course, because that's exactly what we're doing. I do not teach this as a course in Latin or translation, except to the point where the translations matter. I teach it as a course in the structure and function of how a legal system starts to work. And if you go through the Roman laws on the areas in which they worked in, like property, contracts, and torts, and you ask yourself, what's the rate of depreciation of their rules over, say, 1800 to 1900 years? The answer is surprisingly low. Most of the rules that you see there last, a few of them obviously do not. Some of them weren't quite right. but in some areas they're up to 90%. And so if you know this stuff, you have a huge advantage over anybody who doesn't know it, because you've now got two approaches to the same set of problems, which means that you could come up with solutions that somebody who's only trained in Anglo-American law will often miss.
So Richard Epstein superfans will know that riparian water rights are an area where you think Roman law is especially relevant. I'm wondering, we could get very deep in the weeds there. I'm wondering if you can give us sort of the Reader's Digest version of why you think this is such a salient consideration in 2019.
Well, it's one of my favorite topics, and it's the one that we always make jokes about. And the first thing you got to ask is, who is a riparian? And a riparian is somebody who owns land by the edge of a river. And the question that you have to do is to figure out how you work the transitions that start to take place when the water and the land are constantly moving in relationship to each other. And you have to figure out how you keep a set of property rights. So it's important, the first thing to do is to look as to where it is that these rules are situated in Roman law. And it comes after the following topics. The Romans begin with a fairly large discussion of how it is that you acquire property rights in land, how you acquire it in animals, how you acquire it in chattels, all which goes under the heading of occupatio, which in modern law, when we use the same rules, is sometimes called the rules of first possession. That's actually not as accurate as the Roman terms, because sometimes you have to figure out how people take possession of things that are owned by other people. And so there's a priority rule rather than an absolute rule, which is captured in the word first. So they go through this. Then you get to the water, and it turns out that waters move a little bit this way and a little bit that way. This is called alluvial. And the question is, as bare land starts to come up, the question is, does the first possession rule mean that an individual who actually takes possession of that little bit of land owns it? And the Romans refused to do that. The rules of alluvial are gradual movement, means that the landowner who's in contact with the water remains in contact with the water no matter which way. Why is that? Because if you try to use a rule which said that somebody could take that little slip for himself, it would be the classic holdout problem. The slip is of no value except for stopping somebody who has larger values of land from reaching the water. And so what the Romans do is they say, if you own the shore, you then have applied access to the sea. And what you can see is one of the things that you really always worry about with systems of property rights is how you make access from your own private property where you have exclusive rights to a communication or transportation grid like a river or a highway. And if you don't have the right rules of access, all the value that's in the land will be locked up. And so the Romans got that right, and basically those rules carry over almost without a missing a beat in the alluvial situation. But there's then another situation is, suppose it turns out that you have a river that makes a sharp break. And so it used to go ambling down the west coast, then this something comes up, and all of a sudden the river turns and starts to go sharply to the east. What do you then do? Well, you can't use the alluvial rules because there's lots of land in between it. And so what the Romans said is the land that used to be the river is now divided by the two riparians on either side of it. And the new river essentially now creates a new set of riparian rights as between its two owners. And so the land in between doesn't change. And what you never do is you never allow essentially the rules on avulsion to be ignored when it turns out that you don't have an alluvial situation. You have these two separate regimes. There's sometimes a little bit of difficulties with it, but this stuff is used. It's used today in modern times. If you want, I could explain it. In connection with territorial disputes between two nations or two states, and it's also used in trying to figure out what you do to understand various kinds of environmental laws, where what you now do is impose regulation along the seashore to prevent erosion or something of the sort.
You've made comments over the years on the Law Talk podcast, usually elliptically, I think, trying not to take our audience too far into this, but about the fact, I mean, to underscore the salience of this, that there are moments where you think the Supreme Court has misfired on analysis because of a lack of understanding of Roman law. Can you give us some examples of that?
I mean, the one that's most famous is a recent opinion by Nino Scalia called Stop the Beach Renourishment. And it had to do with an environmental scheme which was designed to protect the beach. And the first thing one has to note is that there's a serious collective action problem when erosion threatens all sorts of people along a beach. Because if each individual tries to build some kind of a wall in order to prevent it, and it's only his land, the water will go around the wall and then erode it from behind, and so the whole scene will scale. And so what you have to do is you have to have a common wall that covers everybody. And the Romans sort of understood this because the wall around the river to prevent this erosion is very similar to the wall that you put around a property when you want to make sure that you could fend it off from everybody else. You never allow anybody, when you have a protective wall, to opt out and say, I want to take my shop down and put it somewhere else, so that these things are not divisible and not alienable. And if you go back to the rules on res sancta in Roman law about sacred properties, they have exactly the same property and characteristics that you see in the modern rules. The Romans didn't know anything about optimal behavior, but they got the right rules. So then you have to build this thing all the way up and down the river. And so then what you have to do is you have to figure out how you're going to fund it. And what happens is, essentially, you have to fund it in some way by taxes that are levied against the individuals whose property is going to be protected. And that's also consistent with the Roman public trust doctrine. If the government is going to take over the operation of a river, it has to have revenues from some sort so that it could make sure that it doesn't silt up, to make sure that you can put buoys in there, that you can make sure that it doesn't get polluted and so forth. It's a management problem. And the fiduciary duties of care and loyalty apply to the river as they do to any other venture. So you look at this, and then you come up and you make a deal. And the deal turns out to be as follows. We'll build the wall. We will fund it. What we will make sure that we will do is the following. We will allow all people to walk on what used to be private property back and forth across the beach. And then what we will make sure is that although they may be allowed to walk on the seaside of the wall, they cannot build any obstruction or any obstacle, so that you have rights of access and view over this particular wall if you're the former owner. And this is an absolutely brilliant scheme, because what it does in effect is it takes property, i.e. it lets the public at large use the river, but it gives you an exchange compensation. And the compensation that you have is in the form of protection on the one hand, view rights and access rights on the other. And if you sum those three things together, it gives you a value greater than the taxes that you paid and the loss of the exclusive rights on the far side of the wall. So there's a taking and there's just compensation. Well, Justice Scalia gets to this thing, and frankly, he doesn't know what he's supposed to do about it. And he is very, very nervous whenever he reads the classic text on water law, because they all have the term jus naturae in there, natural law. And as a good modern positive, he doesn't like this. What the words meant, in effect, that these are rules that you impose amongst individuals governing their own relationships prior to the time that there's government in place. And essentially, you think they're so efficient because they last over time, because they are supported by custom, and because they're widely replicable in other cultures. A very accurate test today as to how these things work. But then he gets to the following case, in which somebody has land along a lake. And it turns out that what the government does is it simply drains the lake. And they decide that there's no compensation that's owing, which is just terrible. Because if a private party drained a lake, you would sue it for diversion of waters. And the basic rule of takings is whatever a wrong in the private space may be done by the government, perhaps, but it always has to be done by compensation. So unless you know what the water law rules are with respect to diversions, you'll never get this stuff right. And water is exactly the opposite of land. In land, if you take something out of the pool and make it into private property, you've done a great thing. If you take water out of a river, you've destroyed a commons which has huge value, and you've done a wrong thing. So the first possession rules allow you to take land, and the commons rules prohibit you from taking water in excessive quantities. Complicated kinds of problems, to be sure. So he says there's no property interest. So when he comes to the case there, he looks at the scheme. The only thing he pays attention to is this earlier case, which said that you can drain all the water and not compensate. It was just wrong. And so he says, well, we're not draining anything in this particular case. And so therefore, we've done less of an intrusion. It's perfectly okay. And then he says, oh, by the way, he says, you know, under my analysis, since we haven't taken anything, he's wrong, but he says that, then it appears that you can build a huge building which blocks access and view on the part of the land which is reclaimed by the public. And he says, that's counterintuitive. Well, what he back doesn't understand is it's just wrong. What Nino Scalia did through his entire career was one common blunder. It turns out to run a legal system, you have to know when certain things are going to be denied, and you have to know when certain things are going to be justified. Nino was very, very much away from the justification or excuse side of this business because he never knew the Roman laws of interpretation, which were very rich in implied exceptions. The general part develops out of Roman law, the Lex Aquilia, the tort statute being the most notable example. So he says, you could build this building. Well, that's crazy. Now, why is it crazy? Because if you understood what was going on, you know that the deal was as follows. We take the beach, we put up the wall, we charge you with taxes, and you preserve your light and view. And there's a net positive. The moment you say that there's no taking of the land seaward to the wall, then you could do this stuff, and the bargain gets destroyed. So the reason it's counterintuitive is the deal makes no sense in the way in which he wants to do it. The reason he doesn't get it right is because he simply doesn't understand the mechanisms associated with takings on the one hand and with water rights on the other. And you've got to get both of those things correct in order for you to be able to deal with these kinds of cases. And it is very common today that most modern lawyers, when they have to deal with earlier texts, are so utterly befuddled by what they're about that often when they're arguing these things in front of the Supreme Court, they misread them on a whole variety of issues. So this is not only an argument for Roman law, it's also an argument for medieval English history. Obviously, everybody doesn't have to know it, but it'd be nice if you did. And one of the dangers is law office history, where somebody sees these problems for the first time and then tries to give you a solution. Typically, what they do is they manage to get them rather wretchedly wrong. So knowing the Roman law is a huge protection against various kinds of mistakes. And there are many other illustrations where they get things right or wrong because they do or do not understand the Roman law provisions. The 19th century judges, who were more classically oriented, generally did better on these things than 20th century judges, who have a much narrower view of what their particular domain of expertise is.
So my final question for you, you hinted at this a bit earlier, but I want to get you on the record on this. Where has Anglo-American law been most helpfully influenced by Roman law, and where could it most stand to be more influenced by Roman law than it is today?
Well, I think it's been helpfully formed, for example, in trying to deal with the difference between bona fide and stricti iuris contracts. That is, those contracts where you have relationships, where you have to have lots of implied terms, and those contracts like loans, where essentially they're very strict obligations and there's very little that you can do by way of fiddling around with them. So I think that that has been an area where it works pretty well. I think that the Roman law actually is a better solution in many contract problems because, as I mentioned earlier, they had a much better sense as to how gratuitous contracts ought to be formed than did the moderns. It's also true that the Romans had a very sophisticated law of restitution, a subject that I'm teaching today, which asks the question, somebody takes a piece of property by you for a mistake and they put it into a building and then they modify it in some way. Who gets to keep what between the party who took the thing by mistake and the party whose property has been sacrificed? And this is basically a little situation like the takings eminent domain problem. So the simplest case of this is I build a house on your land. What happens? Who gets it? Does the landowner get to keep the house? And the answer is yes. Does the landowner get to keep it without compensation? The answer is no. What you typically do is you require the person who keeps the house to essentially pay the money. And if he doesn't pay the money over, then the other fellow can foreclose on the property and take the whole thing away from him. And so the Romans developed tremendous rules for these sharing kinds of relationships. And they were much more explicit about how they worked. The Romans tend to categorize. That gives you a lot of information. The modernists tend to say, we don't like categories. So they say everything's just a question of being reasonable under the circumstances. And that opens up a kind of indeterminacy and loosey-goosiness, which is not nearly as good as the Roman situation. So to give you the trade-off, they're always going to be under any system of categories, hard boundary cases between who's a trespasser and who's a licensee. Somebody comes on with the permission of the owner, implied position and so forth. The Romans' attitude was, we get the categories right and let some judge worry about the marginal case. The modernists said, oh my God, we've got these marginal cases, so they abandon the categories and everything becomes a matter of judicial discretion. The Roman system, if you actually understand the way these things work, is a much more powerful and clear set of rules, because what it allows you to do is to not only worry about the extremely difficult case that comes to litigation, it gives you very clear guidelines to do with the millions upon millions of prosaic cases which you have to solve in a cheap and expeditious way, because you cannot always, when you're having a dispute involving very little money, have a full-scale trial in which you weigh the seven factors which somebody thinks to be relevant as to whether or not money is or is not owed for the particular infringement that took place. So categorical distinctions, the whole willingness of the Romans to get the genus and the subcategories and to put them in fashions that actually work is a great achievement. What happened in law beforehand was completely primitive compared to this. And the tragedy is much of the ability of people to understand intelligent use of categories is lost in modern law. And that's a situation where things are worse today than they are if you understood some of the older learning.
All right, listeners, you got your Roman law episode. You wait another 8 years, you might get another one. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.